Ichi, ni, san, da. I believe that's how it went, Adam.
Yes, I believe that is how it went, Mike. And we are back for a very special edition of the Big Audio Nightmare, if you want to call it that, just a couple of days after we recorded our last episode. To be honest, we were planning on doing a show sooner than usual, as it was, to talk about the big Stardom five-star Grand Prix finals show, the pay-per-view that took place this last weekend, do a bit of an express edition of the show, when shortly after that, or I guess shortly before that show happened, actually, the very, very sad news about the passing of Antonio Inoki came out. And Mike, I know you have already talked quite a bit about the passing of Antonio Inoki. If people are not already subscribers to, if they're not already listening to the wrestling news that Mike is the daily host of, I would implore them right now to go and check that out as well. Mike did a tremendous job on, was it this Friday or Saturday edition? Which one was it, Mike?
Saturday, October 1st.
The Saturday edition of that show, sort of a digest format, recapping sort of the career, life, and times of Antonio Inoki. Obviously, there will be much more written in The Observer this week, much more said in long form here and elsewhere. But that is, it was really, really well done sort of recap of what was, like I said, and what is a very sad story and an incredible life. I was actually thinking, spending some time thinking about trying to figure out how I would describe Antonio Inoki to someone who is not familiar with Japanese wrestling and somehow not heard of Antonio Inoki through the fight with Muhammad Ali and everything else. And I came to the conclusion that there is no comp. There is no comparison for any American wrestling figure that you could say, well, he's like Antonio Inoki, because there's nobody that has the combination of mainstream celebrity, industry-changing star power when you think of not only pro wrestling, but what led to MMA, and then the political career that he had, and the when you look at the fact that the guy is credited with saving several dozen, was it prisoners of war in Iraq? Like, a crazy life. Certainly not a perfect life. Certainly not a perfect life in the wrestling world in particular. And we'll get to that. But yeah, what a singularly unique human being.
I talk a lot about online on my Twitter account, A Lion in Winter, when it comes to the great promoters of our time and how once Vince McMahon is gone, we cannot replace him. Once Don King is gone, we cannot replace him. Once Bob Arum is gone, we cannot replace him. And all of the things that they did to get to where we are today, whether it be through pay-per-view, closed circuit, how to promote fights, all those sorts of things. I mean, the incestuous life of professional wrestling and boxing together, and then later on, the child that was born from that, mixed martial arts. And Antonio Inoki is a person who may be very controversial, certainly is complex and complicated, but what an amazing figure. And as you mentioned, it is impossible to draw someone from America that could fit the role of explaining who Inoki was. Inoki was part Ventura. He was part Fez. He was part
Hulk Hogan, part Vince McMahon.
Yes.
He's all those people rolled into one.
No one else has transcended, I think, their sport. Santo in Mexico, culturally, what he means. Rikidozen, obviously, culturally, what he means. But when you prop up another sporting figure, the only one you can really compare him to is the one that he is most celebrated for in Japan and most derided for in America, and that is Muhammad Ali. Because who else could go to Pakistan or India and wrestle in front of 50,000 people? Who else could end up parlaying their fame and working themselves into a position in essentially the Senate of Japan, and then buck censure, and then buck any ramifications that would come from it, and go to Iraq and get human shields away and out of Iraq? before the Gulf War in 1991. What a spectacular life this man has had working his shoots, and then when being pressed to actually shoot and be successful. An amazing life, and how that life he couldn't shake as a promoter, falling into one of the worst traps you can fall into. Why does this not work anymore? This idea I have, my Enochism, should still work, and we're going to jam this thing home. And it's just a phenomenal life, and I don't know how much we could possibly get into because it's impossible to get into all of it. But obviously, Adam, since the time we've been doing not only this show but the Peresu Power Hour, much of the time we have spent focusing on Enoki has been, unfortunately, a negative light because it was during the worst and the darkest times of Enokiism. But I guess, I don't know how much you want to get into, but I guess that's the most relevant part, I think, to where we are today with New Japan Pro Wrestling, because if it wasn't for that dark time, we would have never been able to get pulled out of this. And the fascinating part of Hiroshi Tanahashi admitting much later on that once Shinsuke Nakamura got his eye socket broken in that fight against Alexei Ignashov, where he was pushed as a supernova as opposed to going through the young lion mythology that had always been the way, you know, if he would have left with Muda and Kojima, what would that have meant for Japan, New Japan? What would that have meant? Would Okada have ever left Dragon Gate to go over there? Would it have still been his passion?
Oh, left the Toriumon system. The Toriumon system. Dragon Gate at this point.
Yeah, you know, if that doesn't happen and Enokiism is still there, does he stay? Does he go to All Japan? Again, it's fascinating because obviously Yoshii left, but he didn't pan out the way people thought he would. Imagine what would have happened if Tanahashi wouldn't have been there. And again, there's so many butterfly effects off Enoki too. What if he doesn't give the $1 million to the WWF in 84 for the booking fee? What if he doesn't embezzle money from Anton Hizzle? What if he actually does do the UWF, you know, and that embezzlement thing, you know, pushing money to his firm and everything that shook out of that? I mean, it's just a fascinating life.
Oh, again, there aren't too many wrestler deaths that get feature stories on NPR.
The New York Times.
As you mentioned, too, you and I started doing podcasts together, again, before podcasts were even called podcasts, in the summer of 2005. You had been doing the PPH much longer than that, but you and I started doing stuff in 2005. And at that point, like you said, I mean, we were witnessing a New Japan that was, you know, not the industry leader in Japan at that point. Pro Wrestling Noah clearly was and had been, at least for a couple of years prior up until that point. And New Japan was just sort of kind of starting to claw its way out from under the rubble that the previous, you know, 5-6 years had left them in. And it's, you know, like you talked about, from a promoter standpoint, it's the trap that everybody who is a promoter or a booker, almost everyone falls into this, you know, whether it be Bill Watts when he came back to WCW in 1992 or whoever, where, like you said, you try the thing that worked, the one thing that worked for you, a lot of times with you as the main star, and it doesn't work. And whether it be due to lack of other ideas or ego or anything else, you just keep trying the same thing. And things get worse and worse and worse. A lot of the discourse over the weekend, you know, it's kind of what you see a lot of times where famous legendary figures pass, where there's the argument, there's the discussion of, can we talk about their faults? Is that appropriate? Or do we just talk about them as though they never made a single mistake in their lives, personal or professional life? You know, and I saw some people getting like really upset about, in the midst of recapping the life of Antonio Inoki, you know, people saying and talking about everything you just said about the rise and fall of Inokiism in New Japan and how it nearly killed the company. And to me, you have to talk about those things if you're talking about someone's life, particularly their professional life. It doesn't diminish the towering figure that Antonio Inoki is to say that throwing Yuji Nagata to the wolves was a horrifically terrible decision, just as one example. The other thing I think just, the age that you are and the age that I am in particular, like my relationship with the idea of Antonio Inoki, the wrestler, went through several different phases because, quite frankly, when I first started becoming aware of Japanese wrestling, like most people, when the Great Muta came over to WCW, and then even more so when the WCW New Japan Super Show aired on pay-per-view here in 1991, Antonio Inoki was not largely featured in any real way. But like you'd read the magazines, you knew he was the big star. And I remember having no context as a kid, like finally seeing proper New Japan videotapes, seeing Antonio Inoki and not getting it at all. And just being frustrated, like, why is he beating this guy? Why is he beating that guy? Why is Muto not beating him? Why is Hase not beating him? Why is Chono not beating him? Not understanding who and what Antonio Inoki was, both as a wrestler, as a figure in New Japan and the greater wrestling landscape. And even years later, as obviously you grow up and you begin to understand those things, it wasn't until many, many years later that I really made it a concerted effort to go back and watch his matches from his prime era and really see that, like, you strip away all the other stuff, you strip away everything you said, you strip away the politics, the cultural significance, the fact that he ran the company. He was a great wrestler, and he was a wrestler that had undeniable charisma out of context. Again, when you see it, when you go back and watch, and you're not just thinking, well, this guy isn't Liger, this guy isn't Muta, I'm 11 years old and I want flashy. Like, I've gone back and watched a lot of Inoki, particularly during the start of the pandemic where there was nothing new to watch. And I every time I do, I come away thinking, like, man, I never gave that guy enough credit just as a bell-to-bell professional wrestler in terms of in-ring charisma, the whole package.
Filthy Tom Lawler. I don't know how much he'll get into on his show, but he and Brian, Filthy watched 10 Inoki matches, so I'm
Nice.
fascinated to know what they are and how much he'll get into on his show. But for anybody who was unaware of that, you may want to check that out too. For me, he was like a unicorn because I'm a couple years older than you, and when I moved to Washington, I was in kindergarten. And we had a neighbor up the street, the Schusters, and Eric Schuster, who became a certainly a wheel. I'm not sure of his exact title at Comcast Sportsnet, but when Boost
Yeah, I
Boudreaux,
believe he was actually based out of Chicago for a while.
he may have
That
been.
name sounds very familiar to me.
I don't know if that would be the same guy, but how that Comcast Sports Network thing works, in one town
Yeah.
and another. But when people would come to town, I mean, like with Bruce Boudreaux, they want to see Boudreaux out eating wings with sauce all over his face. Eric was right there with him, his best friend when he came to town. His friends with Kirk Cousins, things like that. But long story short, there is he and his brother were big wrestling fans. They'd always go to the Capitol Center, and they had a collection of wrestling magazines that dated back into the 70s. So I'm talking right now, this is about 81, 82, 83, 84. I guess it would be 82, 83, 84 at the time. So I would look back in those magazines, and Inoki at that time was not that far removed from coming to the States and wrestling at MSG and that sort of thing. But
Which, by the way, I just want to jump in and mention that's one of those things that I had never seen Inoki at Madison Square Garden outside of just clips and doing wrestling at random with Jeremy Deamer. We've had several opportunities to see, whether it be on Coliseum Home videotapes or anything else, see Inoki in Madison Square Garden, whatever it was, 84, 85, the one show that we watched where he won a battle royal. And it's incredible because there's no other Japanese wrestler during that time period that would come over to the United States and would be featured and would be a babyface, whether it be the Battle Royal that I'm talking about from 1985 at Madison Square Garden, or a match that we recently watched, I believe it was from like 1974 in Stampede with Stan Hansen against Antonio Inoki. And Inoki was a babyface there. It's so jarring to see him just presented as Antonio Inoki, legendary, great professional wrestler in the sea of stereotypical borderline racist presentations of Japanese wrestlers in the United States during that same time period.
And that was the thing with him on those Coliseum videos. He's not on there a lot. Like, I think I had seen when I was a little kid to that point, like that battle royal you're talking about.
I think it's on the most unusual matches tape, if I'm not mistaken. It's one of those deals, one of those comp tapes.
Probably was, yeah. I mean, the match against Dr. D. David Schultz for the World Martial Arts title that he had.
That championship is you could basically do another entire podcast about that.
Yeah, but, you know, for the most part, you saw Fujinami, you saw Tiger Mask, you saw Dynamite Kid, you saw some other people, but that's who you saw on those Coliseums. You didn't even see Inoki. But being a boxing fan and a sports historian, even at a young age, like, you know, the Ali thing, I was enamored with Muhammad Ali. I mean, greatest human being to ever walk the face of the earth. I mean, just...
And I remember my dad telling me about that fight when I was little. Because, like, my dad was a huge boxing fan. Not as much now, but grew up a huge boxing fan. So I'd watch boxing with him and wrestling as well. But I remember him telling me about Muhammad Ali fought a wrestler in Japan. And it was, like, this weird, bizarre fight. And then I remember being, like, 12 or 13 years old and realizing, oh... That's Antonio Inoki. That's the guy, yeah. You know?
And that was about all that I had seen from the guy. So I'm growing up at a time where, you know, he's a legend in the magazines because the magazines say so. And because, yes. You know, the chin and the unique look and the towel and all that stuff and the crowds and the banquets and Hogan, you know, obviously the cover. And that's the thing, too. Like, people... Why Hogan was such a big international star? Yes, it was because of Rocky, but it was also because of New Japan, how he was booked and the furor and the fury that was created around him. And with Inoki, obviously, we'll never really know for sure, brother, but him getting quote unquote knocked out and Hogan winning that match and Inoki not losing that match, getting knocked out and getting counted out and Hogan winning the IWGP. I mean, my God, it put it way so far over the top. It was incredible. So, you know, the legend of Hogan wouldn't
be... think back, you talk about Inoki and rarely losing and making people think about Vader defeating Inoki, just mauling him and what that did for his career outside of a little riot here or there.
And the riot it created and all the furor it created. And, you know, there's people that would say, well, why didn't he do that for Fujinami or why didn't he do that for this person or that person? Because it was Antonio Inoki and he was the booker and he was different than Giant Baba, the same Giant Baba he always lived in the shadow of. He wasn't the handpicked guy. Baba was. He was one of the guys. He was really 1A or 1B, but Baba, he's our number one. And he lived in that shadow forever to the point of coming over here to the United States and having to work in territories like Tennessee and having to sow his oats in Stampede when guys from Baba would come over and be touched by the Funks in Amarillo and get higher profile positions, go to Mid-Atlantic and be in the Cadillac of wrestling territories, short trips, big money. Sure, you'd be on the undercard, but look at the life you were living, or going to Vern in AWA and being around Billy Robinson and all that stuff that came with that. And he came over here and he bought a title with the NWF title and brought that back to Japan. He was going to forge a different path. And as opposed to doing pro wrestling that was American style, American based, you know, brought over with the Sharp Brothers, brought over with, and I'm going to brain lock on the person that actually booked all of that stuff who belongs in the Hall of Fame if he's not already in there, and I'm brain locking St. Louis, it's going to drive me nuts. But like, that was an offshoot of American pro wrestling. What Inoki wanted to do was take martial arts and make sure that a pro wrestler be strongest, and he really drove home. Sure, there was all the post-war stuff and the natural stuff from facing foreigners and Americans, Fred Blassie, the Destroyer, all that sort of stuff. But Inoki made it a different type of thing where it wasn't just the Japanese against the world. It was one man and this fighting style and this discipline that some people don't believe in is going to be strongest. And I will prove that against real men, and ended up doing it against real names that people in Japan, again, being so wrapped up in everything, I mean, hey, obviously, look, people want to be worked. You know, we all want to be worked watching pro wrestling. We all, at least at one time, we all did. That's how we all got into this stuff. We naturally wanted to get into it. And people wanted to be worked, and to see him against Ruska or against Spinks or against whoever it would be, I mean,
well, in these incredible different style fights, yes, as they were referred to back then, which,
completely,
you know, it's one of those things too that, again, I think about as the lens of a kid into my mid teenage years, like really discovering Japanese wrestling tapes and seeing stuff from Japan just beyond what was shown every once in a blue moon in WCW. I remember watching those matches and being so confused, because they were so foreign from anything else in terms of the way wrestling was presented here. They weren't necessarily good matches, and that was by design. They were supposed to look awkward and uncooperative and rugged and completely alien to a normal pro wrestling eye, because the whole idea was you're watching this guy with his discipline, as you're saying, Inoki, as pro wrestlers be strongest, taking on, you know, guys that are boxers, guys that are Sambo fighters, guys that have a karate background. It was supposed to look strange, and it did.
And then, of course, times change. Everything changed. And those mixed
fights... Well, times
fights...
changed because real fighting came along in a mainstream major way, and it had evolved so much by that point that you could not throw a pro wrestler in with a true mixed martial artist, even a pro wrestler with the background of a Yuji Nagata or with the background of an Antonio Inoki before him. You could not throw in a pro wrestler of that caliber, even with a legit background, and have them survive against a high-level MMA fighter. And you know, the biggest mistake from a promoter booker standpoint that Inoki ever made, in my opinion, was like, whatever, you did that, I get it. That's what your character was. That's who you were as a wrestler, and you wanted to recreate that. But the second it became apparent that that wasn't going to happen, you needed to pull the chute and figure out a way for your wrestling to stand parallel to that, and bring in, you know, when you could, some of those legitimate fighters to do realistic looking work shoots with your guys and have them put over your guys, but never put a Yuji Nagata in a situation on almost, you know, no notice or disciplined fight training against a Mirko Krokop, or, you know, putting in a Shinsuke Nakamura against an Ignashov. Like, those things, you didn't need to keep going down that road, and you did, and we all saw what happened.
What filled his personal account with riches ended up ultimately draining his creative account. And what made him famous, which were works in what were supposed to be real fights against real name fighters.
Well, that's the whole thing too. Like,
that
think
was the
about
great,
from
yeah.
the sort of warped logic. And I guess part of it is just believing your own press clippings to the point to where truth and lies almost don't exist. That line is obliterated in that Inoki's idea to keep New Japan / bring New Japan back to prominence was to put, with no safety net, his top wrestlers in legitimate fights against top fighters.
Adam,
when it's, as Adam, you said, what made Antonio Inoki Antonio Inoki was him beating fighters in worked quote-unquote, shoot different style fights.
And don't forget, Adam, he would do this by placing these matches on shows that would go directly in competition with his own.
Yes, absolutely. Which is even more insane. You would have a New Year's Eve show or some other show that would be, whether it be the same day or 3 or 4 days before, you're not even getting the benefit. You could at least make the argument that if you're doing these fights and you put them on a New Japan show, well, it sucks that your guy got killed on that show, but at least you're making the money off the gate that drew. By and large, that was not the case here.
No, it was not. And that was the case with Shinsuke Nakamura. And the thing was, Nakamura was a really good amateur wrestler, but he was part of this shoot favors thing that's going on. And one of the bizarre things that Inoki will be getting forgotten about is who is one of the people that he brought to prominence over from Brazil to Japan?
Lyoto Machida.
Lyoto Machida. Jungle fights that would take place with Nakanishi and guys like that. And the
Lyoto Machida, what he roomed, was it with Danielson or someone at the LA Dojo, the original LA Dojo? Yes, you had Brian Danielson, you had Rocky Romero, you had Alex Kozlov, Samoa Joe worked his way through there from time to time. You had all these guys. Lyoto Machida was one of those guys there. Yeah. There's an alternate reality where Lyoto Machida is New Japan's like second or third coming of Antonio Inoki.
Shoot Fabers, I actually called them in a Pro Wrestling Torch article that I'm actually going to bring back to life, and because it's a long, crazy one, and I was really upset after watching Nakamura get beat and get his eye socket broken in a fight.
Well, yeah, there's a reason why. If you're someone who saw Nakamura and Takayama January 4th, 2004 at the Tokyo Dome, and you're like, man, that Nakamura looks like such a badass with his eyes so dark. Why are eyes so dark? Why does he have the black eyes? That wasn't makeup, people. That was a very real effect of a very real fight.
They take the title off of Tenzan, put it on Nakamura, rush him in because of that reason. Wins the title in November because we're going to have him fight in December against Alexei Ignashev. And there were two Alexei Ignashevs. This was the K1 version that was mainly a kickboxer. And the thinking was, unlike Yuji Nagata and Mirko Krokop, who they severely underrated and had no clue what was taking place when they decided to match those two up years earlier, Nakamura looked like he could beat Ignashev. And the fact of the matter is, he kind of was in some ways because
he made it three rounds.
Yeah, and he kept taking Ignashev down. And the fact is, he couldn't do anything really with him. So he probably wouldn't have won the fight. But the fact of the matter is, he did keep doing that until Ignashev timed the takedown, delivered the knee strike. Immediately, you know, Nakamura popped back up, but it was immediately known to the doctor that he was out for a second and he suffered real damage, which at the time was nerve damage, the sinus damage, the possibility of having both eye sockets broken, although that ended up not being the case. And then he's got to go out there and face Takayama. And
4 days later, wasn't that the unification of the IWGP and NWF titles, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, and the thing was,
it was to seal the NWF title.
The problem with that was Nagata was scheduled to go face, it was Akiyama for the All Japan title a couple days later. And now
for the GHC title.
Yes. Now, ultimately,
in Pro Wrestling Noah.
Ultimately, you'll never be able to tell me that the fight between Jerome LeBanner and Tadao Yasuda was not worked. I know everybody will tell me otherwise. I will still swear it was worked because Nagata losing ultimately led to that main event where you save the day with Yasuda, and Yasuda goes on to win the vacant IWGP Heavyweight Championship. So, did that change things with Nagata? Maybe not, because Kojima ended up, you know, the deal happened there, not with Kojima, but everything happened the way it happened, and then you move on. With Nakamura, he goes and he's basically, I'm not saying he's getting stiffed, but he's wrestling a Takayama type of match against Takayama, all banged up. And the thing was, even though he was going to win, he didn't look as impressive as Nagata did in his match going for that crown. So you still lost something, and then he had to vacate the fucking thing anyway because he was hurt, and that drove me nuts.
I mean, Nakamura, if you haven't seen that match, Mike is not overstating it. He got his ass handed to him by Takayama and then won the match at the end. Like, it was, that was a Yoshihiro Takayama mid-2000s ass kicking of Shinsuke Nakamura. Like you said, it's one of those things that you should have seen coming if you're a promoter, but you didn't. That's a bit of a rabbit hole that we went down here, Mike, but that's all to say, the legacy of Antonio Inoki in professional wrestling is very, very complicated. There's no New Japan Pro Wrestling if Antonio Inoki didn't exist. The Japanese wrestling landscape is completely different if Antonio Inoki never existed. We talked about the impact he had on the world in so many different ways. It's also true that we were very, very, very close. And I don't think people are even willing to acknowledge how close we were to New Japan as a company ceasing to exist entirely, specifically because of how Antonio Inoki ran the company. So it's, you know, if you're talking about someone's life, those are all parts of it, particularly when you're talking about their professional life. But taken as a whole, again, still, I can't think of too many more towering figures. And as I said, too many more singularly unique or influential figures in their field than Antonio Inoki was in pro wrestling and by extension, mixed martial arts.
Yeah, he's just so incredible that you can't, when you peel back the onion, it reveals another layer that then reveals another layer. Yes. And he's just that big of a personality and has that big of a legacy.
50 years from now, there will still be layers and stories being revealed.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true.
It's guaranteed.
That's true because of the political exploits, because of all of these things that he did, will people, again, how many stories, and God, because he was 79 years old, so many of the people that could tell these stories have already passed on. But there are a mountain of things, whether it be good, bad, indifferent, humorous, serious, disgusting, magical, inspiring. There are so many things that could continue to come out for years and years and decades afterwards on Antonio Inoki. And Adam, if I can, I'll probably at the end of this broadcast, just for the heck of it, I'll probably tack on the 7.5-minute bio that I did from the wrestling news.
Absolutely.
And what I'm also going to do is, because I know it made me think about it because I have a copy of some of the WWF programs that I have from like Madison Square Garden. I have one with Inoki on there, and I know at some point on the show we talked about the whole Inoki Backlund title change that I think stemmed from a Wrestling at Random discussion that we were having. So what I'm going to do also is put that at the end of this show, too.
What that was sort of at the beginning of the pandemic. Remember, kind of at the same time that I started Wrestling at Random with Jeremy, we were trying to figure out, okay, there's really no wrestling happening. What are we going to talk about on the podcast? And if you recall, we had each week we would do four random New Japan matches, or I think it was New Japan matches. We'd put up a poll, we'd have people choose, vote on them, and then we'd watch that one match and talk about it. And one of them was, in fact, that one of the Inoki Backlund matches, and we talked quite a bit about the entire backstory there.
Yeah, so that I'm going to tack that on to the end. So you know, this is now truly become a very special episode of the Big Audio Nightmare. Stardom's 5-Star Grand Prix wrapped up on October 1st at the Mushishino Forest Sports Plaza.
Beautiful arena, by the way. I am shocked. Has any wrestling company ever run there before? I am not familiar with this building. I thought this looked awesome. It's a longer arena. There's a small upper deck. The stage setup for this was fantastic. We'll talk about the show as we go through, but I thought some of the entrances, particularly the Starlight Kid entrance for her match with Mayu Iwatani, I thought was one of the most visually arresting, breathtaking, whatever you want to say, pro wrestling ring entrances in a long time, with her coming out with the entrance gear, that big video wall, that like weird like cloud of like black ink sort of art on the screen as she was starting to come through. It was just really, really impressive.
It looked big time, and of the entrances did, and there's been a lot of talk
about it. Honestly looked to me, sorry to jump in, but this to me was pro wrestling wise, the most a show visually looked like Pride in a long time to me.
It gave you New Japan Big Show vibes, and having the production.
It did it to me, because New Japan Big Show, I feel like New Japan doesn't usually go as strong on the video screens, the entrance videos. I don't know. It gave me Big Show vibes though, for sure. And I'm not talking about Paul White. Like this seemed like a, you know, and it was the attendance was 2,343. So good attendance, nothing groundbreaking, but still, when you look at previous years of 5-Star Grand Prix finals, obviously an improvement, but just this looked like a major company having one of their biggest shows of the year.
Yeah, that it was new, like New Japan production level feeling, because it felt like a big time production, money sunk into it. They had the facility to do it. And why it looks better than New Japan's is, in my opinion, because the aesthetics are better on these videos, and some of the music is a toss up. You know, does it fit the character? You know, Okada being a great example, Tanahashi and Stardom, you know, it's the same sort of way. So when everything hits, when all of the other non-wrestling gaga, the aesthetics of the costumes and things like that, when it all hits and you make a big walkout on a big stage, whether it be New Japan, CMLL, WWE, it brings everything up. It's part of the whole deal, and they did a fantastic job with that.
Think about when everyone talked about how massive and how big time the Cody Rhodes entrance felt at WrestleMania. Obviously, not saying this is on the same scale, but when you see someone like Starlight Kid and her entrance here, or Natsupoi and her entrance on this show, best way I can describe it is the way I said it on Twitter a couple days ago, where you've got people who are legitimate stars, and the presentation of them on this big stage takes them from a star to seeming like a superstar, a larger-than-life character, even if there's someone who is as physically small as a Starlight Kid, for example. It's really home run presentation by my estimation.
Hazuki, Kamatani, Julia, obviously.
They all came off like stars. The best way you mentioned New Japan. When I watch this show, and again, the New Japan comparisons I get can be a little bit tiresome. I don't even necessarily like making them all the time, but I feel like it's the easiest entry point for people who aren't regular fans of Stardom. Everything about this show, and maybe even more so on the visual presentation standpoint, but the feeling of watching this, it felt like, you know, a final night or a final couple nights of a G1 Climax 4, 5, 6 years ago.
That would be fair. That would be very fair, because...
But bigger because of from the visual presentation standpoint, the entrance that we talked about. But again, it's because of the depth of roster. It's because the amount of legitimate, believable options there are to win a tournament like this, or to win the Cinderella tournament, or to win the red belt or the white belt. There are so many people that either are a legitimate option, or that you can easily talk yourself into being a legitimate option, and they're all great and they're all stars in a different way, that when you watch a show like this, like, your mind is sort of spinning at the possibilities of how it could end up, with the two blocks meeting in the final night, even though we'll get to it. I mean, the final was literally what I predicted on last week's show, on the preview show. And the winner is who you and I have been saying for at least months, if not longer, going back to last year's tournament. It was clearly going to be the case that Julia was going to win, and that's exactly what happened. But still, you could suspend disbelief very easily throughout the show and believe that any number of people, whether it be a Tam Nakano or a Shuri or whoever else, Tommy Hayashishida, had a very legitimate chance of coming away with the trophy at the end of the night.
That was the key thing going into the final night, was you had a variety of people who all had a shot, even though you had obvious figures that looked as though they were going to win or were favorites to win. But you still had a lot of drama and question as to how you could get there because of how they weaved this whole thing together. And
well, the people that had a shot, I just want to jump in. The people that mathematically had a shot were, for the most part, believable. It's not like you're coming down to the last night, and Tama Tonga has a chance, or Chase Owens has a chance. You know, somebody who you just don't think is going to win, but they're in that spot. I think of, separate from a tournament setting, but going into the next major New Japan show, we talked about it last episode a couple of days ago, where I don't think anyone believes, for example, that Tama Tonga is going to win the IWGP World title, or that Jonah is going to defeat Okada for a second time. So there's a different level of believability in terms of the outcome being in doubt, and whichever way it goes, that being okay. I mean, you could rattle off 10, 12 people on this show. I mean, I could do it right now. I mean, you could say Saya Kamatani, Mayu Iwatani, Starlight Kid, Julia, Suzu Suzuki, even Izumi, even though she hasn't been pushed to that point just from pure in-ring level, Utami Hayashishita, Tam Nakano, Shuri. You could say believably any of those people would have been a satisfying winner in this tournament, and you would say, oh, that's not a stretch. They're not being pushed beyond their ability, or they're not being booked in a weird way here on this show.
And the red block was more messy, you know, with possible winners coming out of it. The blue block had less variables and also had Julia, so yes, there was a little less doubt there, although they still stacked the card in a way where it built up to the drama. And for most people listening to this, it is too late to buy the pay-per-view. It's available until Tuesday, October 4th at 10:59 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. After that, you're going to have to wait till it comes on Stardom World, but it is
a
show.
Won't have to wait long, though, because usually the situation is that after that, I think it's 3-day exclusivity window ends on pay-per-view. It usually comes up like the same day or the next day on Stardom World, particularly if you look at the pay-per-views on the 23rd and the 25th. It was pretty quick. So I would assume if you aren't able to order the replay in the next day or so, that it will be available. I would be shocked if it's not up by like Wednesday.
Yeah, we'll take Stardom World. We'll take this from pillar to post, but we'll also point out if you're strapped for time, you know, 3 or 4 matches that you have to see coming out of this thing. But again,
I'll jump in right now again and say the match you have to see. Obviously, it's a tournament final. You're going to watch the tournament final. It was great, but to me, one of the most incredible matches I've seen not only this year but in recent years, the 15-minute draw between Julia and Suzu Suzuki. Particularly if you're even aware at a cursory level of the controversy of when Julia left Ice Ribbon, which is where Suzu Suzuki came from as a very young wrestler, and all of the controversy that that was sort of an outgrowth of that when she first joined Stardom, and then consequently as well, the controversy on the Ice Ribbon side and any sort of ill feelings or shock, from the likes of Suzu Suzuki and other people in that company. The emotion that these two brought to the ring, you talked about the entrances, both, particularly Julia, was already crying on her way to the ring. Before the bell rang, during the introductions, both Julia and Suzu Suzuki had tears flowing. And it was this mix of like true sadness sort of tears and angry, I'm going to beat the hell out of you tears, kind of all mixed into one. And then when the bell finally rang and they went at it, they're beating the hell out of each other. There are tears during the match as they're beating the hell out of each other. The finish where as the bell rings, Suzu Suzuki is just hitting Julia over and over and over with forearms. And as she's doing it, crying, just trying to knock Julia out, Julia just grabs her and hugs her. This was something else.
Might as well start at the very beginning, because the very, very first match plays into what could have happened on the rest of the show. It's Saya, Ida, and Mirai. And Mirai actually, I take that back. Mirai ended up getting up to 15 points, but she was one of the people that, up until the very end, was kind of in the mix. And obviously, Saya, Ida was at no point in the mix here, but this was a really good opener, a nice power versus speed matchup. There was a lariat exchange.
I'd say power versus power. I mean, Mariah's got great ring speed, but she's every bit the power wrestler that Ida is.
Yeah, and much bigger, too. Ida looks more impressive with a bodybuilding background and everything, but Mariah being a little bit bigger and ended up using the modified bow and arrow. The
Miramare. There's Miramare. The stretch, and there's also the shock version, which is sort of her cradle shock finisher.
And this one, the had the left arm and leg cranked back, and she ended up getting the submission victory. So she finishes with 15 points, which was very impressive. And the night started with all blue block matches, which led into the red block matches. And the next one that was up was a battle of
Cosmic. Well, we should also just quickly mention, you said very impressive. It's a great showing for Mariah that points-wise, you take away tiebreakers or anything else, but points-wise, she ends the tournament in a three-way tie for runner-up, and that's following up her winning the Cinderella tournament. So you talk about, we said before, someone who came into stardom and shot to the top like a rocket. She definitely fits that bill. The second match, Mina Shirakawa and Natsupoi, we talked about it a couple days ago, how you would say good, I would say great Mina Shirakawa has become. This match, I thought, was awesome for 8 minutes. The finishing sequence was great. Shirakawa hits a dragon screw that I think Natsupoi is still spinning from. Maybe the best dragon screw sell I've ever seen, followed up by, hands down, and I've been watching wrestling for more than 35 years, Mike, Natsupoi's sell of being in this figure four leg lock for Mina Shirakawa was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in terms of selling a submission. The best sell of a figure four I've ever seen. The pain, the drama without going into melodrama, and then finally tapping out, submitting. Just a masterclass of how to sell the pain of a submission hold by Natsupoi here.
Yeah, I'd have to rack my brain and go back and compare it with figure four sells of the past, but it was a very good one. And it was a long, without being, drawn out, it was a long fight by her to try to reach the ropes and to try to survive this thing before she ends up finally tapping. Afterwards, everybody cries, which, I will always say there's too much crying in pro wrestling, although I get it with the group and the type of competitors that they are. But again, like you mentioned,
Too much crying in pro wrestling? I think there's not enough. People should show their emotions, damn it. They should feel it all.
Well, Shirakawa.
I say that in all sincerity, Mike.
I still think there's too much crying, but it doesn't matter. What matters is Shirakawa is a lot better than she's been, and we've talked about it, and this was a very good performance by her. Obviously doesn't hurt Poi in the least at all. She's still screaming right now somewhere, and she's going to have a tag team title match that she's going to have to be ready for, which we'll end up talking about soon anyway here. But an impressive performance. Shirakawa ends up in double digits, still finishes behind Natsupoi, but an impressive tournament for Shirakawa. I thought also an impressive tournament for Hazuki. Momo Watanabe, this was... You'll probably like this match more than me. This was a really good match that when it got off the rails, just jumped right into Bullet Club, House of Torture type of territory for me.
I agree with you. I thought this was very good, but I can very easily imagine these two wrestlers having a much more satisfying match for my taste in pro wrestling than what this was. The action was good, but like you said, the ref distractions, all that sort of stuff was a little bit much for me here. I think the biggest story, though, is just, Hazuki getting out to that crazy lead in the first month of the tournament and then never winning a match afterward. To me, it doesn't really matter because the story is that she had a tremendous tournament and raised her stock considerably. Usually the banana peel slip is a final night thing, not a final month of tournament thing.
Well, that's true, but we've seen this with other tournaments like the Carnival and the G1 before, where when you are going to have people bunched up, somebody is going to have to jump out to a big lead. Somebody's going to have to take some L's. And we saw Suzu Suzuki start, 0-3, I believe it was, to start this thing.
0-3 and then also miss the first couple of shows with the COVID stuff. And so that added to the effect of her just storming back in.
That was actually one of those beneficial things, silver lining things that ended up happening because of the story that was being told. It worked out great, I thought that way. When it came to Hazuki, I thought the story is still going to be told here because in those seven tournament matches that she won in a row, It was Julia. It was Starlight Kid. It was Natsupoi. It was Mirai. It was Suzu Suzuki. And yeah, she beat Shirakawa and Hanan too. But it's those other matches that now you have an automatic on a show to put her in, and for a reason to put her in. And she still had a chance to actually win this thing at this point in the show because she had 15 points and Starlight Kid had 14 and Kamatani had 14 and beat her head to head. So she had to win this thing. Hope Kamatani lost and hope Julia lost. Obviously that didn't happen with Watanabe getting the win. But because of the stakes, because of the fact that this is the finals of your big tournament, and it actually had an effect on what could have been the end of this tournament, to have all of the referee distractions and him getting pulled out and all that stuff, I thought it sucked. And the thing was, this was really good until it wasn't. And then when it wasn't, it ended up going on for too long.
Yeah, I can't argue with any of that. Again, action was good, but it could have been better. Saya Kamatani and Ame Sori, don't have a ton to say about that. Double countout. I also think there's a much better match between the two of them there, but it served its purpose. Something different on the show, double countout, had the effect on the points that it had. I thought Sori had, we talked about before, I thought she's another one of the people that really leveled up in this tournament, and the experience is invaluable. I guess if Kamatani keeps going down the line as champion and you run out of other challengers, you could potentially, have Sori challenge her based off the fact that, well, Kamatani didn't beat her. I think there's other people that have a stronger claim to title matches coming up. We'll talk about that later. That was followed up by, this is sort of when we get into the run of very good to great matches that take place at various points on this show. Mayu Iwatani, Starlight Kid. You go back to, Starlight Kid's long run as part of Stars, her being the protege of Mayu Iwatani, being tag team partners as the MK Sisters. Stars loses the unit battle match with Oedo Tai, forcing Starlight Kid to join Oedo Tai, where I think everyone at the time we talked about it thought, well, man, this is a big risk because Starlight Kid is maybe one of the best baby faces in wrestling already. How is this going to work? I think a lot of people thought, and I know we talked about on the show, that this would end with Mayu Iwatani somehow winning Starlight Kid back, them having another unit battle match, and she'd get Starlight Kid back into Stars. Instead, Starlight Kid enjoys being on the dark side and becomes a willing member of Oedo Tai, and in the process becomes so much bigger of a star than she ever had been or would have been going forward. The character that she's developed as Starlight Kid in Oedo Tai is perfect for her. She's one of the biggest stars in Japanese wrestling right now. And so they've had a few matches here or there. They've had interactions, but this is one of the highest profile interactions they've had since that whole split. And I thought this was fantastic pro wrestling for the time they had allotted.
Yep, and Kamatani in the match previous, if she would have won, she could have gotten into the finals. Obviously, she fails. Same thing goes here with Starlight Kid. She needs the win to try to get past Julia, who only had 15 points at the time. So here she is with Iwatani, who she's the SWA World Champion. I never remember that.
Well, and it's another wall still for Starlight Kid to climb. I know some people are frustrated that, that Starlight Kid didn't win here. I certainly wouldn't have minded seeing her win, but the points, it was not the story they were trying to tell having her win this. And as big of a deal as the 5-star Grand Prix is, I still think before, there's been the rumors of Mayu either retiring next year or the year after. Whenever that happens, before Mayu Iwatani steps away, Starlight Kid will beat her, and it will be in a singles match on the biggest stage possible. So I would just say have a little bit of patience. I think the booking in Stardom has earned some faith here. So I think it's coming. It just didn't happen this weekend.
Yeah, and Julia Nakano is it's a bigger looming shadow of a story to tell than anything
absolutely.
You're doing with Kid. And you still tell the story, like you mentioned, of Kid getting over the hump here with Mayu, which at some point she will. So, Mayu finishes with one more point than Starlight does. You know, that long triangle choke that Kid had on Iwatani, who finally made it to the ropes for the break. I thought that was a really good spot in the match. And ultimately, Iwatani gets the victory, and that sets up Julia and Suzu Suzuki at the end. And, you know, here was a case where, okay, I'll take the crying in the match because, again, I was almost crying in this match because I don't want to see Suzu Suzuki's participation in Stardom at any point come to an end.
No,
this was
no, and we'll get to that later. The only disappointment that I have about the tag league, we'll get to that.
Yeah, and the only disappointment about this match is it ended. This was an excellent, excellent match. Julia needed a win or a draw to advance. A loss would put Iwatani in. Suzuki would win the block outright by defeating Julia. You know, she with two matches in Stardom, she beat Mai Sakurai and she had a draw with Mirai. So those are the only two Stardom matches, singles matches she had leading into this tournament. And she goes
well, those
and she
were on New Blood shows, if I'm not mistaken. At
yeah.
least the Sakurai one was. So yeah, really, as far as proper Stardom matches, very, very, very minimal participation in singles.
And then she, all the delay, and she loses to Mirai, and she loses to Suzuki, and she loses to Poi, and it's like, okay, well, let's see what we do here. And then she has the match with Saya Kamatani that was awesome. And then she has a match where she loses to Mayu Iwatani that was really, really good. And then at that point from there, she goes on the run. The Watanabe match, you know, probably stands out the most. Same thing.
Well, I would say the one that stands out the most to me was the Starlight Kid match.
Yeah, obviously.
That was tacked on to the Stardom and Showcase show. We talked about that a couple of days ago. What a fantastic
Absolutely.
Match. Absolutely. If you are a Stardom World subscriber, that show from the 25th is up now on Stardom World. And yeah, run to watch that one.
This was a great match. Obviously, 15-minute draw means we can have a lot more on this table. It was played perfectly. Suzuki not backing down to her veteran foe respects her, but she's going to hit her back. And that was apparent right off the bat. Are there maybe sometimes too many headbutts that are actually headbutts, probably? But you know what? Who the hell can tell Julia Suzuki what to do? I certainly
no one.
Can't.
Talk
so,
about people that are ungovernable. Yes.
Let me ask you a question, Adam. Let me ask you a question, because there is going to be a battle, obviously, for Suzu Suzuki if she ever comes into the promotion. As long as there are factions, you are probably going to have some sort of bid for her. It's not locked in stone that she would align with DDM. So let me ask you.
She shouldn't be in any of the existing factions in Stardom.
Well, there's
to me, too unique of a character. She doesn't fit in any of them.
Well, look, yeah, and there's a separate talk to be had about moving forward, what the factions mean, and should everybody be so reliant on them and have more lone wolves, as Dragon Gate did and as other promotions have that also rely on factions, because she would be the perfect one to kind of be a lone wolf, or maybe even just to, I guess, to stick with prominence. But say you wanted to bring her into an existing group, like, it's either, to me, if it's not DDM, it's like it's a Wedo Tai or it's nothing. And I can
see
her.
I don't think she fits in a Wedo Tai at all. We talked about it last show, and I can't remember. I apologize. Whoever it was on Twitter that mentioned this, they kind of put it into better words than I was able to last time when I talked about how, like, a Wedo Tai are like the kids trying to be bad, and then here comes Suzu Suzuki, who's actually just a bad dude, so to speak.
Well, there's why I ask, because if you want to keep these factions for marketing or whatever the reasons are, her taking over that faction and remodeling that faction into her own and actually maybe bringing in some people that fit, who are younger, that fit more of her mindset, is that within the realm of possibility, with considering they like to shake up groups every year or two?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mess with what they're doing with the Wedo Tai right now. Them is like the, I don't know, the like Mean Girls Pro Wrestling Squad, I think works. And I don't think Suzu would fit in that. I think it's prominence, or if she does ever sign full-time with Stardom, building a that style of stable around her versus plugging her in. I just think she's too dynamic of a character, too unique of a character, and too commanding to be sort of shoehorned into something that already exists. Either way, I want more of her in Stardom. And I think, if nothing else, I would be shocked, absolutely shocked, if early next year, when Julia, after Julia beats Shuri for the title, because I don't see any scenario where Julia doesn't win the red belt at the end of the year, I would be shocked if there isn't a major arena show headlined by Julia versus Suzu Suzuki for the World of Stardom Red Belt Championship.
After Julia and Suzuki, that was kind of the magic halfway point of the show, and they put a red towel in the corner, held a 10-bell salute for Antonio Inoki before we got started with the red block matches, which started off with Sayaka Unagi and Momo Kogo, and we'll get to Unagi once we're done and all wrapped up here, and what her future may be in Stardom, at least in the near future, at least. But she defeats Kogo, so they both finish with 4 points. I really don't have a whole lot to add, coming out of the break. It was the perfect match, didn't mean anything when it came to the tournament, and it was what it was in 5 minutes.
Yeah, the only really note I had on it was that if Unagi is going to use this move, this Taiga de Ata, I would much rather see her use it against someone the size of Momo Kogo than the near-death experience several months ago of her using this move against Lady C. And I'm not blaming Unagi on this solely. Nobody involved with this. That match should have looked at that move and said, yes, Lady C is going to be able to take this move, this sort of half underhook vertical spike type of move. It's hard to describe if you haven't seen it, but they are so lucky, everyone involved with that match a couple months ago, that Lady C was largely okay coming out of that. But yeah, not a whole lot to say about that match otherwise. The following match, Saki Kashima against Izumi. Again, another one where Izumi had a legitimate chance to make it through to the final. But Saki Kashima, as she had done several times throughout the tournament, getting big wins against champions or former champions here, in 44 seconds, defeats Izumi with the Kishi Kaisei roll, which I believe this is pretty much exactly what I predicted a couple days ago would happen. We'd have a crazy high-speed exchange like you'd usually see in an Izumi high-speed title match, and it would end abruptly, very quickly, maybe even under a minute, with Saki Kashima hitting a roll. That's exactly what happened. I did like how in the 44 seconds that they had here, they each had near falls stealing each other's roll-up finishers before Kashima got the win with her own roll-up. About as good of a 44-second match as I think you'll ever see.
Yeah, how you feel about this match is pretty much how you feel about Izumi. And if she had a shot to win, she needed a lot of help. She needed to get the victory here and needed a lot of help to actually get into the final. But 44 seconds, it was going to happen in one of the matches. Obviously, you'd love to see these two women do a lot more than 44 seconds.
Which will probably happen. I'd be shocked if we don't see Saki Kashima challenge Izumi for the high speed title at some point. No one loses anything getting beat or getting beat quickly by Kashima, because they've established that while she's sort of a mid-card wrestler, the cradle she's developed is almost impossible for anyone to kick out from. So it's not as if Izumi doesn't have great company in people who have also lost to this move.
Yeah, and it looks cool, and that's really all that you need to know. So, again, it
Yes.
was going to happen to somebody. You have these matches, it had to have happened the same way all that nonsense, even though it was too much, had to have happened in one of the matches, happened to be in Watanabe's, which, again, if it was going to happen in any of them, have it happen in just that one, and that's what they did. The next match, you didn't need any nonsense in Hutami Hayashishita and Koguma. This probably, I don't know if this was a surprise for people, but I guess, Julia, obviously, again, with the way things went and with Nakano and everything, Hayashishita had a chance to win, and I don't know if I would have tabbed her to beat Koguma. I don't know, but Koguma ended up getting the victory. It ends up leading to an angle afterwards
Well,
where
before we get to the angle, let's talk about the match itself, because that finish, we talked about just a couple days ago that the finish to Higuchi versus Takeshita was maybe the best finish of the year. That lasted 2 days, because this finish with Hayashishita going for the hijack bomb, which is her spinning Splash Mountain, Razor's Edge, whatever you want to call it, and all in one motion, Kaguma being up in the air and hitting a perfect, absolutely perfect, the cleanest you've ever seen out of midair, Code Red, Yoshi Tonic, whatever you want to call it, and that actually being the finish instead of a meaningless near fall, unbelievable. This match is worth watching just to see that finish.
Absolutely.
Kaguma is someone who, just like Kashima, she's maybe at a little bit higher level in the company, but she's someone who, she's most likely never going to be the red belt or white belt champion, but she's won the tag titles, and she's someone who, she can beat anyone on any given night, and it's believable. And I just think also she's someone who should be given a ton of credit for really working herself into being a very, very good wrestler again. When she first came back after years away, whatever it was, last year, it did not look like this was someone who was necessarily going to be able to wrestle at a high level. Like, she just, I had questions seeing her first few appearances, her first few matches, just the way she moved. It just didn't look like someone who was going to be able to pull it off. And she has gotten to a very high level. And yeah, so this was very enjoyable, particularly that finish.
Yes, that was gorgeous. And as you mentioned, all in one motion, it was perfect. Surprising, maybe, but how they ended up finishing off the red block, no surprise. What they ended up doing afterwards as well, this led to the angle with Natsuko Tora, who I didn't realize has not been around in a year. I guess.
Well, no, she, if you recall, she had the red belt championship match last summer, challenging Utami Hayashishita, and got hurt early on the freakiest of things. They were out on the floor. Hayashishita was on the floor. Tora was standing on the apron and just, not like jumping for a dive, just sort of like lightly jumped off the apron, stepped off the apron to be on the floor and continue the attack, and destroyed her knee. Absolutely obliterated it. It was very, very hard to watch. Felt terrible for her as she like tried to get up. The match was, you know, there was a long delay in the match as they were trying to see if there was any way possible that she could continue. Clearly she couldn't. Very, very, like I said, sad thing, hard to watch. And then she's been back for like ringside for a good portion of this year, but I was beginning to wonder if that was kind of going to be her role going forward, if she was just going to be kind of almost a manager type for Oedo Tai that got it physically involved here or there. But no, it looks like she is back. She is back as a wrestler, and she is ready to take revenge, I guess, for that missed opportunity against Hayashishita. That's who she's targeting.
Yeah, and she, you know, she was back earlier on for Momo and Hazuki, you know, at ringside, and she came out in a mask and a cape and jostled about and ended up having the mask come off. And of course, you know, because, you know, it's pro wrestling. Hayashishita was in pure shock, got kicked in the gut, and then had to listen to Kaguma basically tell her, or to Tora tell her, that she wants her revenge. And they ended up, we know now they're going to have a singles match on November 3rd in Hiroshima. She's back for the tag league as well, and we'll end up getting into that a little bit later on. So that's how that whole thing plays out. So it ends up with Hayashishita out of the tournament, but having something to do now coming up. That led to Tom and Nakano and Saki, and Nakano needed to win, and Siri needed to lose or draw, as Nakano held tiebreakers over Mika and Himeka, which was still a match that was upcoming. So all of the stakes ended up really getting jacked up after that match, and the intensity was back up on the show because, again, all of these last matches that we had leading into the final all had something to them. They were all very unique matches, and they all looked like they could be very physical. And I thought Nakano and Saki in its own way was, and I thought it was, again, a very, very good match. It just, to me, I don't want to say you forget, again, I don't want to say you forget sometimes, with Iwatani and Nakano are just so good, and they've been so good there for so long, and we see all these newer people coming in, and we get the new reign of Julia, and we've seen the ascensions of, you know, Siri and other people in the last couple of years. Like, they're just so great all of the time. And I know they won't put Nakano's age up there because she's aged out of putting her name up, age up there. But who gives a shit? She's so fantastic. Put her age up there. Celebrate the fact that she's a little bit older. Celebrate the fact that she can still hang with all of these other young people, even though I know Saki is not that young. But my God, I thought as good of a 7.5-minute match as you can get. Clear victory for Nakano, leading herself into, hopefully at that time, for her sake, was the final, as we ended up finding out it would be.
Yeah, I thought this was very good. I wasn't necessarily quite as high on it as you are. I thought Nakano was great. I think Saki's good, but I don't know that I would say that she's really any better than good. The right result here, though, Violet Screwdriver, Tam Nakano wins and avoids slipping on the banana peel that pretty much everyone else did leading up to this point. And that's what made the like, you look at these matches, you had Izumi losing to Kashima, you know, at least points wise and standing wise, an upset. Obviously Koguma beating Hayashishida, an upset. And then this was sort of positioned to be the same thing. Nakano gets the win, as you said, keeps herself alive. We then had Mika and Himeka, tag team partners, stablemates in Donna Del Mondo. This match, I believe, got the in the sort of post-show awards that took place in the ring. This got the Red Stars match of the tournament. This was awesome. Double knockout, just under 10 minutes. It's one of those matches where it's like, yeah, I wonder what it would look like if these two wrestled each other. And this was one of those where I was like, yeah, that's pretty much at the high end of what this would look like. It was great. We've talked about before that, like, I think Himeka is one of the most underrated wrestlers in Stardom. I don't know if she's ever going to kind of get beyond the level that she's at right now, just because there's so much depth. But I'd love to see her get a reign with one of the top two titles. Mika, I think there's a better chance. I don't know, just kind of looking at the way they position her and then the performance that she had in this tournament. I know we talked about it a couple days ago. I really think there's a non-zero chance that in the next couple of years, Mika wins one of the top two belts. I don't think it's going to be coming up on November 3rd. I don't think she's going to defeat Shuri to win that championship. But I would not fall over shocked if we see a scenario where, let's say, in the next couple of years, Natsupoi wins the Wonder of Stardom Championship, the white belt, and then maybe Mika defeats her, as one example. I think that that is potentially something that could happen.
We're not a tag team promotion, per se, and they've already done it. But man, these two together as a team is just so great. To me, it
yes.
is. And I think I'd love to see them over in the States. I really would, because of the style that they work that is different than some other people's. And I think they, again, I like them a lot. I don't know individually where they get to. I'm a little more, believe it or not, bullish on him and Himeka.
I mean, just to be clear, I think I'm with you personally in where I think at this point each of them are as singles wrestlers. I just get the sense, and maybe I could be wrong, but I just get the sense that Mika is someone that the company might be behind a little bit more.
And you know what? If that is the case and she does win a belt, it makes it that much easier for Himeka to actually challenge her for a belt,
yes.
or to face her, or to transition that belt over. So, it, you know, again, they're both really very good, and it is going to always be tough to break the upper mid card in Stardom, especially with the talent that they have. But, you know, Mika, it is more, you better strike sooner, because she's another one whose name, you know, whose age is not put up on the screen there. When it comes to Himeka, she's only 25. She's part of that 25 club, you know, that everybody that's around that age in that company. So, you know,
well,
they're
both people who also came from outside the Stardom system,
yeah.
and leveled up considerably. Like, they're two of the first wrestlers, when you look at sort of this Bushiroad era of Stardom, where they're, a ton of growth and also roster growth in terms of bringing in people left and right. They're two of the first people that were part of that and really, really both have. I mean, Himeka was good right off the bat. She had a little bit more experience, whereas Micah had just a handful of matches coming through JTO. But Micah has improved dramatically over the last couple of years. Like, you could see the potential, but she's gotten, while still not losing any of like the power fighter, judo player aspects of her as a wrestler, she's gotten so much more smooth and confident when she's in control of a match than she was just a couple of years ago.
And anybody that wants to feel a way about somebody from the outside coming in or the prominence faction or anything like that, Micah, Himeka, Julia, Thekla, they're all now looked at as stardom wrestlers. I know they had a past.
Natsupoi, Mirai. Even. Natsupoi, you don't necessarily think of them as being people that came from Tokyo Joshi Pro in the last couple of years.
Yeah, or Ice Ribbon or anywhere else. But the fact of the matter is now these women are stardom wrestlers. I don't think of Micah and think JTO anymore. The same way I don't think that young karate fighter that's there now, what's her name? Brainlock, and who I'm talking about.
Tomoka Inaba,
yes.
Who also is from JTO and is now a member of God's Eye and will be teaming with Shuri in the tag team tournament.
She's another one. Once she's in stardom for like a year, I'll never I will conveniently forget she was ever a part of JTO, and that's because stardom also right now is hot. And because everything is clicking. So, again, great examples from almost all of Donna Del Mondo who have come and blended themselves in and done perfectly. Obviously, they needed a way out of this match. Ends up going to a double knockout because if either wrestler won, they would advance to the final. That set up ultimately the penultimate match of the night, but the final match really in the red block, Shuri and Risa Serra, where if Shuri wins, she's in. If she loses or draws, Nakano ends up getting in. Obviously, that ends up being the case. Risa Serra, great performance by her, I thought, throughout
this
tournament.
Great performance all tournament.
Absolutely.
She was, to me, one of the revelations of this tournament.
Yes, and they treated her with the reverence that they were treating. Look, she is the top star of prominence. She's the top star of the group that came in. And perfect. Her and Shuri, both the same age, both unique now. You can make them kind of rivals with each other, with Sarah getting the victory, probably going to lead to a championship match down the line, I would assume.
I don't think so. I mean, she already had the title shot a couple months ago against Shuri.
Oh, that's
so
right.
I think this is sort of evening things up as much as anything. I thought this was a much better match than their title match. And it also, to me, followed a bit of a trend where we talked about a couple days ago, the Shuri Nakano match in the tournament was, by my estimation, at least much better than the championship match they had. I really think outside of Hayashishida, I really think Shuri is much better in shorter time limit matches than matches that go 20 or longer. And I think both the Sarah match and the Nakano match here show that.
Yeah, I agree with that when it comes to both her and Filthy Tom Lawler, to be honest. So, because that's what they are. They're fighters and they can finish fights fast if they need to. And
but at like 12 that, like, I don't know, 8 to 10 to 12 to like 16 minutes, a lot of times for that style of wrestler works better than, sort of artificially dragging it out. Unless it's a match where you've got two people wrestling that style and you've got believable mat work and, that you've, 8, 10, 12 minutes in, you've got, a cross arm breaker or something that's a legitimate, feels like a legitimate finish. You can bring people up and down. Otherwise, I think the constraints of the 5-star Grand Prix 15-minute time limits definitely benefited Shuri here.
And this was, and I completely forgot about their match before, but this was, I like the finish, the crucifix arm bar that Shuri had on her ends up getting reversed into a pin. So it made complete sense. It's not a fluke, it's a skilled wrestler reversing a pin, and sometimes you know, hey, back in the day, you know, we'd see title matches in the NWA like that all the time. Hey, every once in a while, that roll-up monkey flip or whatever it was would get the victory, and damnedest thing that would happen. And that's what happened here with Sarah, which ends up putting Siri out of the tournament and putting Nakano into the final against Julia. So I thought this was another one, a very, very good match here, you know, leading into the final. Maybe not one of the three or four best on the night, but a very, very good match.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. The final you mentioned, Julia and Tam Nakano, you talk about rivalries in Stardom, particularly over the course of time of the last couple of years, if Stardom was really going into running these major arena shows. To me, I mean, I don't know. Some people look at, I don't know if you look at Hayashi Shida and Shuri, or you look at, you know, some of the rivalries Mayu Iwatani's had. But for my money, of the last couple of years, Julia and Nakano is the rivalry in Stardom and the rivalry in Japan. And just the variety of matches, the emotion, you go back to the hair versus hair match, which was so good. And I mean, desperately wish that would have been during a time period where crowd responses would have been, vocal crowd reactions would have been allowed. But to me, it always felt, we talked about ever since Julia's injury last year, forcing her out of the tournament that she seemed to be slated and fated to win. This seemed like Julia's year. It seemed like her tournament. And, you know, if you're talking about, well, who's the opponent going to be, and there being some drama in that, if Julia's finally going to win the five-star Grand Prix, what better opponent than it being Tam Nakano, particularly when you look at who else was in the Red Star. She was clearly the best option if you're looking to sort of tell that story. And you know, the way they booked this tournament in terms of which block they kept her in, or which block they put her in, meaning Julia, they kept a lot of other potential single matches and matches that will be title defenses for her down the line once she wins the red belt. The red belt, so many of those matches are still fresh. You know, you've got so many people in the blue block, whether it be back it up. She was in the blue block. I'm looking at things wrong. Damn it. The show's been too long. Forget all that. Forget all that. They set up a bunch of title matches, the big title matches, by her wrestling Starlight Kid, by her wrestling Suzu Suzuki, by her wrestling Mayu Iwatani. They're actually, again, to completely contradict myself, when you look at the red block, the people she wasn't in matches with, there really aren't a whole lot of really, really compelling potential matches for Julia down the line that she hasn't had already. Hayashi Shida seems super fresh. Like, it feels like they've very rarely interacted. Izumi, yes, but otherwise, it's either people that are part of her stable or people you wouldn't necessarily be clamming for matches for. So, anyway, there you go.
Well, first of all, I do a show with Brian Alvarez, so if you ever make that kind of mistake again, just immediately don't say anything and just flip it into what you really meant to say and just keep going and plow through, because you're never wrong. You know what I mean?
See, that's the, I have that horrible character flaw of being able to admit I screwed up.
So, also, as you meant, look, yeah, Hayashi Shida and Izumi for sure, you know, but obviously there's Kairi. There are matches that you make. Yeah, I don't think you're going to have any problem with opponents for her. That's for sure.
Oh, my God. No, again, just look in the blue block that I completely screwed up on earlier. But look at the people in the blue block alone that she had matches with, that there could be title defenses down the line. Natsupoi, Watanabe, Hazuki, Kamatani. Obviously one of the hallmark matches of 2023 is going to be Julia and Mayu Iwatani. You know, we've seen the draws before. That obviously is going to be a huge match next year. Starlight Kid, Suzu Suzuki, which we talked about earlier. Yeah. All those are potential title defenses, much less, like we said, the possibility of a Hayashi Shida and Izumi. Maybe even if the rain goes really long, finding a way to get another Nakano match in there.
This was a great case of the most obvious thing is sometimes the right thing to do. And I know, just because you you wanted to. People wanted to see maybe somebody else other than Julia win, and they were coming up with ideas, or they just wanted to see, okay, how could somebody other than Julia win this thing, and then what could you do? But this was Julia's year to win, and there's much to do, I think, with her. I think she takes that red belt, and there's no question that she does and goes on, and it'll be an interesting year to see where she goes. Does she go to Europe? I think she comes to the States, no question. It'll be fascinating. You know, Kenny Omega and Toshiko Joshi Pro in Stardom, can they coexist and make their way on alternate weekends to AEW shows? I don't know. But
that's one of the, it's something I was actually thinking about yesterday. It's one of the, I mean, I can't say it's a big frustration because I'm thrilled that we've seen, you know, obviously the likes of Yuka Sakazaki, Miyu Yamashita, Maki Ito in AEW due to that relationship. But man, if that is in any way holding up the possibility of getting, you know, people like Starlight Kid or Azumi or Julia or Tommy Hayashishita, just as some examples, on AEW television, that's a shame.
Northern Lights bomb in 17 and a half minutes, in case we didn't tell you that. Obviously, you already know that Julia came out of this thing victorious. And
this was a great match. This was, oh man, I know I've been raving nonstop about the Julia Suzu Suzuki match. This was great in its own way, an exhausting bomb throwing war. As you said, Julia wins with the Northern Lights bomb, which is sort of her super finisher. That she breaks out to put people away when they've kicked out of everything else. We had a crazy sequence of one count kickouts of each other's finishers, which was awesome. Then the finishing stretch was just Julia destruction of Tam. She hit we talked about that Vader hammer that she throws, which is just instant death. She then hits a Kamigoye, the Glorious Driver, and then the Northern Lights bomb for the win. The story, the never-ending story that is Julia and Tam Nakano continues.
Would it be fair to say that's their Rock Austin, in that when, if you were to ask Stardom as a company, if it could talk as one entity, it would say, if you said, hey, give us one thing that exemplifies what you are and really showcases what you are, you think that would be it? Because you ask fans, they might say, well, I like Foley and Triple H, or Foley Undertaker, or I like this and that. But if you actually, if you had one representation from the company, I that is as close to one to me. That is the one I think it would be.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is for me. As I talked about earlier, there's so many, I mean, to me, the two defining rivalries of the past couple of years for Stardom are, or I guess there'd be three. For me, it's Julia Tam, it's Hayashishita Shuri, even though that's a bit more of a compressed time frame on that, and then it's Azumi Starlight Kid. But to me, particularly, Azumi Starlight Kid and Tam Julia just feel like, as long as those two pairings are possible, they will continue meeting throughout different periods of their career, and the story will just continue to build on itself. One thing I did want to mention quickly, Mike, because we did have a couple questions come in from people on Twitter after you asked if people would have any questions. We have a question from, I believe it's Kevin McElvaney of PWI, the editor-in-chief of PWI, asked if we had any thoughts if we were going to talk about, as he said, the shades of Enoki Ali ground kicks from the five-star Grand Prix final. I didn't think about that as it was happening. It's a good call. I also just love the idea of the two of them each sitting and kicking each other in the face, as we saw as well. But yeah, certainly something that seemed relevant on that night.
Very apropos. And again, great professionals to do that. You know, good, smart, good thinking. And I just want, Kevin is one of my favorite people in all of wrestling media. The chief cook and bottle washer over there at PWI, the man who does everything and does
and think
amazing
about as well,
job.
Like, PWI had fallen into, you know, kind of irrelevance for a while. And so to me, it just makes me so happy as a kid who, like, my wrestling fandom, my taste in wrestling, my understanding of a world of wrestling outside of just what I got on my local TV PWI is massively important, and it makes me very happy that that it's in good hands and that it seems to be thriving, even if the arguments about the PWI 500 are still ridiculous.
that's the best part about them. I think it's time, though, high time we mix the women into the PWI 500. And I think, you know, talking about these types of stardom shows is one of the reasons why. And, you know, PWI has had a, as you mentioned, it fell because it's all periodicals did. It's tough to keep up the turnaround.
Periodicals. How old are you that you call a magazine a periodical? It's like when someone calls a TV show a program.
Yes. Yeah, so look, it was tough to balance and make the turnaround. And they've done a great job balancing the time, the lag of going to publishing with everything that happens after that and still having relevant articles. And that was the whole thing from PWI from the past and Inside Wrestling and The Wrestler and all those other Westin After magazines is you're going to be 2 months down the line of the stuff that happened. So what stories do you have that could still be relevant? And I think they've done a really good job with that. And they're focusing on women's wrestling, talking about some of that stuff, being forward-looking, having Kaia McKenna in there. And just I really enjoy what they've been doing, and it's been yeoman's work. And I continue to buy it at the store and not have a subscription just so I can continue to buy it at the store. And maybe that guy puts it in another store because I'm the idiot who still tries to buy The Ring and Pro Wrestling Illustrated on the bookshelf. But they've done a great job with it. And I think, hey, look, maybe it's time that we start talking about Siyuri and all these other women, you know, in the mix with the men for that PWI 500. Why not? A wrestler's a wrestler.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't argue against that. I wouldn't be shocked if that, you know, I guess the argument would be from the PWI standpoint, like they try to look at win-loss records who's wrestled who and how do you judge when it's the vast majority of it is women wrestling men. How do you judge, you know, if Shuri should be ahead of Kazuchika Okada or if Okada should be ahead of Shuri.
And you know what? They got to sell two magazines too, and I don't blame them for that either. So you put that women's 150 out or whatever it is. I respect it. But, hey, look, I know we're running out of time here. There was a lot that ended up coming out.
Well, I did want to before. I want to make sure we mention we had another listener question. Let me pull it up here. I believe it was Matthew Harold. At Matthew Harold 83 that asks, first, is there any logical answer you could give for Julia not to win the red belt? As I said earlier, absolutely not.
No.
You never know, but it seems I cannot fathom that you would not put the belt on her at this point. He also asks, if Stardom keeps on the upward trajectory they're currently on, do you think Bushiroad might bring back the two-day Tokyo Dome with New Japan on January 4th, Stardom on January 5th in 2024, 2025? It's a really good question. I mean, at this point, I think it's wise to not put any caps on where Stardom can go in the next couple of years, particularly as things start to open up. We've said ad nauseum, they're the only wrestling company in Japan that's shown growth rather than contraction during this time period throughout the pandemic. I mean, I could easily see a scenario where you have January 24th, you have Wrestle Kingdom with one Stardom match on it, and then I could see, you know, some sort of version of Wrestle Kingdom the following night that is Stardom based, and you have one big New Japan match on that show. I wouldn't fall over shocked if we see that at some point.
I think
a lot of it will be, by the way, a lot of this is going to be determined by how successful this show coming up on November 20th is, because if it's not as successful as we think, maybe they back things down. If it blows away their expectations, whether it be attendance, whether it be pay-per-view buys, just general interest, I think there's going to be on both sides, on both the Stardom and New Japan side and corporate Bushiroad, there's going to be a lot of interest and maybe even pressure to continue to continue this tie-up on even bigger scales going forward.
They ran the Bell Sal Shinjuku Grand Hall last year. I'm not sure where they're running for January 3rd this year. But
Yokohama Budokan is going to be a major show there.
Okay. I would say that it would be a mistake to run the Tokyo Dome with a stardom only show. That's one thing for sure. Now, we are moving towards the time of, I think, all events where if they can get 2 days out of a weekend, much like WrestleMania, I think they're going to do that. And I don't blame them for that. There's different, you know, you can feel as though what you want about that, but what that would open things up for is definitely a lot more stardom participation on both shows, maybe two or three matches, including pre-shows on both shows. So I think that's something that would make sense to me. I think having the third as your own show for now at a big building and focusing on it and making that part of a package for the weekend, you know, running that a dome adjacent or sure.
Well, maybe you end up with a scenario where going forward, not obviously this coming year, but night one, Wrestle Kingdom is Wrestle Kingdom. Night two is basically a version of what we're going to be seeing in November with this joint New Japan Stardom show. And if this, let's just say, and I have no idea, but let's just say November 20th sells out Ariake Arena and does great pay-per-view numbers in Japan. Maybe they look at, well, the next step for that is instead of running it in November of 2023, we instead do that January 5th of 2024. Who knows?
Yeah, we could fantasy book out a lot of their business. You know, what if things really work out well and you decide not only are you going to have a dash on the 5th, but in the afternoon you're going to have a stardom dash somewhere where you want to build off of that and, you know, kick some more things into gear, things that happened on the New Japan show and things you want to move forward moving into Cinderella or whatever. You know, whatever you want to do, there's a lot you could do. And there's rumors coming out of the Grand Prix that Unagi Sayaka is going freelancer because she is not booked on any stardom shows, yet she is booked on JTO and Diana shows.
Yeah, and she's been doing, even before this, she had been doing some outside of stardom stuff, kind of separate from what we've seen from other stardom wrestlers. So I guess that, I wouldn't be shocked at this point.
No, and here's the thing. It would make perfect sense if she's still, you know, doing stuff for stardom. But if you're not going to be booked and you got other stuff to do, go do it. They got a lot of people in the mix. Her going to go do something else. And again, it's addition by subtraction in a way, too, because she's not exactly the best worker. And if she's going to go and actually get some more work somewhere, hey, it might be a benefit for everybody. So I love Sayaka as a character. She is what she is. I don't think she's really even going anywhere. I think she's just, but again, even if she is, where else is she going to go and have more shine? And where is she going to be a better fit than be a part of Cosmic?
Isn't still doing stuff with stardom. I just think it's going to be something more like, you know, whether it be the prominence people or you've got, you know, the members of Colors that are, you know, they're part of Cosmic Angels, but they also still do their own thing. I would say that's probably the direction that it would go with Unagi.
It's indie wrestling. Salvatore Bellomo was a maniac in ECW for a while, lost all the time on WWF TV. Why? Because bigger fish, smaller pond. Perfect for Sayaka to go back out there. Now, Julian Suri, it was announced, obviously. Julian made the challenge after the match. Everything has been tidy and fixed up here where, you know, the same show that Suri won the title on December 28th at Sumo Hall, Julia gets the red belt title shot there. Hard to believe that Julia won't win it there, you know? So there is that. And from the red belt, we can go to a different belt. Not the SWA title, as I talked about earlier on, the much maligned in my eyes title. No, the brand new IWGP Women's Championship, Stardom and New Japan both here. Royal Quest 2 in London. Jazzy Gabert defeated Ava White, and lots of women could have been placed into those positions in that match. It was a very stardom thing to do for me, to have Jazzy Gabert and Ava White wrestle for that title or wrestle in the tournament, but Jazzy Gabert moving on now to face Kairi in the international portion of the bracket. The other IWGP women's title semifinals have been set. It's Mayu Iwatani against Momo Watanabe and Utami Hayashishida against Emeka. So that is going to take place on October 22nd. Gabert is also now part of a new faction of this was interesting. They announced this during what, the show on the 30th, 29th, whatever it was, the show right before this, the Neo Women's Stardom Army with Jazzy Gabbert in the lead. And I guess that was a way to try to do something to have her have involvement in Stardom. I just thought it was odd, but I guess her being in this whole tournament was odd to me. But I think at the end of the day, we won't have to worry about her anyway, and we're going to see one of the native Stardom women end up coming out of this with the victory. Or, and I'm counting Kairi as part of that, even though she's part of the international bracket.
Yeah, I would think you're 100% right on that. And I would say, yeah, it's funny kind of who they had on the international bracket. That felt much more like Stardom of a couple of years ago as far as the type of foreigners that would be brought in versus the Stardom of today. But yeah, it'll be interesting. Yeah, I can't fathom it wouldn't be anyone other than the four people that you mentioned wrestling coming up later this month, or Kairi having the international bye. We did have other announcements, a Stardom press conference yesterday. They announced the full card for the big November 3rd show in Hiroshima. Shuri versus Micah for the red belt, which should be very good. It kind of is stuck in that spot of certainly not seeming like there will be a title change there, but that should be very good, particularly coming off Micah's victory over Shuri. We also have the match that you and I had speculated on quite a bit a couple days ago, when Mina Shirakawa would get her white belt championship shot. That will be on November 3rd, part of that double main event. And then I guess you could call it a triple main event, because we have certainly four big stars, the Goddesses of Stardom Tag Team Championships, Natsupoi and Tam Nakano, defending their belts against Momo Watanabe and Starlight Kid, in addition to Mayu Iwatani against Alpha Female and Utami Hayashishida against Natsuko Tora. So a pretty big show coming up in almost exactly a month's time, I would imagine. Definitely a pay-per-view.
Yeah, on paper, I really like this, too. That six-woman tag with Mariah Misori and Konami against Julia May Sakurai and Thekla.
Yes, Konami being back. Sort of a satellite member of God's Eye again. Good call.
Yeah, you know, Alpha Female now facing off against Mayu Iwatani, going against the old guard. I guess they're going against the old guard and the new guard of Stardom, I guess.
Yeah.
So there's that, and plus all the title matches there, including that Mina Shirakawa one. So, yeah, you know, the Micah match, obviously, being a big Micah fan, it's one of those things where, well, she's going to lose to Siuri. That's just the way that one's going to go. But the fact of the matter is, it's only going to benefit her, I would assume, being in there. We know she can thump. We know Siuri loves the thump as well, too. And this leading into her match coming up with Julia and DDM, you know, again, it's just very simple storytelling. That, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes the most obvious thing is just the right thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. And if that does sort of sacrifice some big matches along the way as far as predictability, I think that's, you know, it's the price you pay for that. They also, at this press conference, announced the Tag League participants. There is, in the Blue Goddesses block, Mirai and Amisore, Mina Shirakawa and Saki, Hanan and Sayada, Izumi and Miyu Amasaki, who we haven't seen in a little while, the super rookie coming back to team with Izumi. We have Hizuki and Koguma reprising their team. We talked about earlier, Micah and Himeka. The big new group, the stable that you talked about, they're represented here with Nanai Takahashi and Yu. And then Natsuko Tora and Ruaka. Meanwhile, the other block, Mai Sakurai and Lady C, Shuri and Tomoko Inaba, which we talked about earlier, Mayu Iwatani and Momo Kogo. This could be actual Mayu Iwatani and person playing Mayu Iwatani in a movie if Momo Kogo gets that role. Julia and Thekla, reunited as Thekla has returned. Momo Watanabe and Starlight Kid. Saki Kashima and Fukigen Death. Tag team champions Tam Nakano and Natsupoi. And Utami Hayashishida and Saya Kamitani reprising their team. My favorite note about all this is some of the team names. There are a lot. We won't go through them all. The greatest tag team name of all time, Mai Sakurai and Lady C, are known as My Fair Lady.
Sure. Sure.
This is the greatest tag team name of all time.
You
They
don't
may not win a single match in the tournament, but they should get tag team name MVP at the final night.
Not Saki and Fukigen being We Love Tokyo Sports. I mean, wait a second. I didn't know there was going to be money involved and that type of selling. It's like Wade Boggs going into the Hall of Fame with a Tampa Bay Rays hat. This is a sin. This should have never taken place. But yeah, so, and you know, before, look, we started this show 2.5 weeks ago and we got to get out of here. But one thing that we were talking about before the show was you mentioned All Japan Junior Heavyweight Champion Atsuki Aoyagi, and he's got a match now scheduled on October 23rd against Minoru, a title match, but he just had a title match. But All Japan, Stardom wasn't the only one at a press conference. All Japan announced some stuff as well. It's just, unfortunately, in their 50th year, they're not as big as Stardom is right now, so it's kind of getting drawn out a little bit. But they did announce a bunch of matches, including a Triple Crown match and Oyagi against Minoru, but he just came off of having a title match with Hayata, you said was really good.
Yep, Rising Hayato and Atsuki Oyagi had an awesome All Japan World Junior Heavyweight title match, the best, I would say, for that championship in several years, and it main evented at Korakuen Hall. So that was very cool to see as well. We talked a little bit off air before the show, you know, all this talk of, you know, mostly coming from us about like who can be the 1A or 1B, however you want to say it, to Kento Miyahara as far as a difference maker in All Japan. Maybe we'd been looking in the wrong place the whole time. Maybe All Japan is finding their, on a smaller scale, but finding their Hiromu with Atsuki Aoyagi being a guy who could actually, you know, main event a Korakuen show and get a decent number by current standards, defending the title. So very cool to see there, like you said. Excited to see the match with Minoru coming up. The Kento Miyahara Takao Omori Triple Crown match sort of coming out of left field, but I guess it makes sense. 50th anniversary, Omori, you know, trained by Baba. It makes sense, I guess, in this time for him to get that title shot. But yeah, very good match. Good stuff there. The only negative about that All Japan show, the Saito brothers join Voodoo Murders. Can't win them all.
Nah, it's just unfortunately, it sometimes bees like that sometimes. as Iceman King Parsons would tell us all. But hey, just also shoehorning this in here because All Japan, both All Japan and Game Changer Wrestling, along with Freedoms, both ran Korakuen Hall on Sunday. Freedoms and GCW announced 820 people. All Japan announced 821. There is good promotion right there to always do the plus one. At both of them at Korakuen Hall. And unfortunately, we're not, number one, there's not time to talk about it. Number two, we haven't seen it. The perception I saw online and from the reaction that a lot of people, down to even people like Danny Demento, came out and said was, you know, congratulations to Game Changer. And apparently it was a very good business weekend for them. It's been a very good tour for them. They just came back from England, I believe it was, and immediately went over to Japan with a lot of guys, including Nick Wayne, who's going to get a damn Ribera Steakhouse jacket at the age of 16, well, 17 years old. You got to be 19, I think, or 20 to drink in Japan. And at 17, he's going to be getting himself a jacket, him and Jordan Oliver over there. So really good for them. And apparently it was a really good weekend for him. So, you know, good on them. Were there any of the matches were any good? I have no idea, but I guess that's a feather in their cap.
Yeah, certainly I would agree. Feather in their cap. Exciting to see whether it be a Nick Wayne, a Cole Roderick, some of the really good wrestlers in GCW get a chance to wrestle in Japan, get a chance to wrestle at Korakuen Hall. And yeah, for GCW, continue to raise their profile there. So I think, unless you have anything else, Mike, I think we can wrap it up. As always, you can check out my stuff, Wrestling at Random, Three Count Fall newsletter. Obviously, check out Mike's great new venture, The Wrestling News, and all the other stuff you've got going on as well, Mike.
I don't know how many Mid-Atlantic Championship podcasts will be going on, but definitely The Wrestling News every single day. Wrestling Observer Live, Monday through Friday as well, too. So there is that, and we shall be back to you probably pretty soon, depending on how the schedule looks and everything. So there you are. That's what it is. And I guess that's that.
That is that. This is a throwback to the old days. Two shows in 1 week, a couple days apart. Can't say it's going to happen that many times, but glad it did this time. Hope you enjoyed it. And yeah, as Mike says, we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, stay tuned for the classic stuff. Bye-bye. We begin today with the passing of one of professional wrestling's most successful figures, Antonio Inoki, one of Japan's most revered sporting figures of all time, passed away last night at his home in Japan. He was 79 years old. The news of Inoki's passing was broken by Yahoo Japan. Heart failure was the cause of death, according to a report in newspaper Asahi Shimbun. Inoki, the founder of New Japan Pro Wrestling and a former elected member of Japan's House of Counselors, had been in ill health in recent years. Born Kanji Inoki in Yokohama City in 1943, he was a protege of Japan's first major wrestling superstar, Ricky Dozen, breaking into the professional ranks on September 30, 1960. He debuted on the same night as Giant Baba, his future tag team partner and a career-long professional rival. Following Ricky Dozen's death, Inoki toured the United States in 1964 and 1965, after which he was approached by Tanyanbori with the idea of leaving JWA, the company that had been founded by his late mentor. They would start a new wrestling promotion named Tokyo Pro Wrestling. The enterprise lasted only two tours, and in 1967, Inoki returned to JWA, forming a tag team with Giant Baba. The two were Japan's biggest wrestling stars. In 1972, Inoki formed New Japan Pro Wrestling after being fired from the JWA for an alleged attempted coup. Inoki built his company around what he called strong style, incorporating various forms of martial arts to make his product as realistic and believable as possible. With Giant Baba's All Japan Pro Wrestling already having an affiliation with the National Wrestling Alliance, Inoki was forced to create his own governing body and to purchase or create his own world championships. Inoki and New Japan also formed a relationship with the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, Vince McMahon Sr.'s company, booking foreign wrestlers for New Japan. Internationally, Inoki's sporting fame peaked on June 26, 1976, when he famously faced off against legendary boxing champion Muhammad Ali inside Tokyo's Sumo Hall. In what is now considered by many to be the precursor to mixed martial arts fights, the fight was planned to be a worked affair. Ali's side panicked before the fight, demanding rule changes which led to Inoki crab-walking and kicking Ali's legs for 15 rounds. Inoki had a brief run with the Worldwide Wrestling Federation World Championship in 1979, but that title reign was not recognized outside of Japan. Inoki had also previously purchased the NWF World Championship in order to make himself the title holder and to bring the belt back to Japan. In 1989, Inoki formed the Sports and Peace Party and was elected to the House of Counselors in Japan's National Diet. Before the start of the Gulf War, Inoki received attention for liberating Japanese hostages in Iraq after direct negotiations with Saddam Hussein and his son Uday in 1990. Inoki has been credited with 41 people being released. He served until 1995 and was re-elected in 2013, this time representing the Japanese Restoration Party, serving until 2019. In 1995, Inoki promoted an event in North Korea at Pyongyang Stadium in front of 190,000 people, the largest live crowd to ever witness a pro wrestling event. He defeated Ric Flair in the main event. Inoki would retire as a wrestler on April 4, 1998, in front of a sellout crowd at the Tokyo Dome, defeating Don Fry. According to the Wrestling Observer newsletter, to that point, the approximately $7 million gate and $2.6 million in merchandise sales were all-time pro wrestling records. Inoki always carried with him the philosophy that professional wrestlers should be viewed amongst the best athletes in the world who compete in the preeminent fighting style. Through his work shoot fights and in-ring exploits, Inoki's pro wrestling be strongest mentality brought him fame and helped elevate New Japan Pro Wrestling to great heights. But as the 2000s began, mixed martial arts grew as a fighting art, and the discipline's dedicated fighters quickly became much more well-rounded. This would lead to problems within New Japan Pro Wrestling, as Inoki's insistence that his professional wrestlers take MMA fights began to backfire, with an embarrassing series of one-sided losses that eroded the public's faith in the legitimacy of pro wrestlers as fighters. One of the most infamous occurred on December 31st, 2001, when Inoki promoted his own mixed martial arts event. In the night's main event, New Japan wrestler Yuji Nagata was knocked unconscious in 21 seconds by kickboxer Mirko Krokop. Nagata, a standout collegiate wrestler who was being groomed to win the IWGP Heavyweight Championship days later at the company's biggest show of the year at the Tokyo Dome on January 4th, was thoroughly humbled, and his professional wrestling career suffered badly. Inoki's insistence that his professional wrestlers continue to train as hybrid fighters, who are also versed in mixed martial arts, continued to create issues towards the end of his ownership with New Japan. Weeks after shockingly winning the IWGP title, on December 31st, 2003, during another nationally televised New Year's Eve MMA event, rookie wrestler Shinsuke Nakamura, who Inoki was trying to rebuild the company's Inokiism philosophy around, made it into the third round against K-1 fighter Alexei Ignashov before a knee strike to the face abruptly ended the fight. With morale falling and the company's image at a then-all-time low, wrestlers began openly rebelling against the influence of mixed martial arts on the company's style. In January 2004, Keiji Muto left the promotion to assume control of All Japan Pro Wrestling, taking top heavyweight wrestler Satoshi Kojima, top junior heavyweight wrestler Kendo Kashin, and several office personnel with him. Years later, Nakamura's generational rival Hiroshi Tanahashi would admit that he was also encouraged to leave Inoki, but chose to stay. Inoki remained in control of New Japan until 2005, when he sold his controlling interest in the promotion to video game manufacturer Yuke's. After the sale, Inoki would create the Inoki Genome Federation, which attempted to be a hybrid pro wrestling and MMA company. Once again, legendary professional wrestler and patriarch of New Japan Pro Wrestling, Antonio Inoki has passed away due to heart failure at his home in Japan. He was 79 years old.
And on a completely different note, although I guess you could probably order, you could really just order Antonio Inoki's briefs or Bob Backlund's briefs from like the Haynes.com website. We are going to be talking right now about the match that somewhat surprisingly, pleasantly surprised, won the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare New Japan Rewatch poll for this week. Antonio Inoki versus Bob Backlund from November 30th, 1979 for the WWF title. This is quite the hidden gem, quite the time capsule for New Japan Pro Wrestling on New Japan World.
It really is, and I'm kind of surprised that this won the poll. You know, Bob Backlund, I figure, you know, people wouldn't mind seeing us review an older match, but to a lot of today's fans, Bob Backlund is a kryptonite rock, almost, they don't want to deal with howdy doody or anything like that. And this is also a match that in some circles has been, kind of put down a little bit. There are a lot of people that look towards a 1978 match that Backlund and Inoki had in Tokyo. And they look at that and they say, well, that was a great match. And this one with some of the things that went down in it, it was kind of looked down upon by some people, but, I'm glad I had a chance to watch it again because I haven't watched this in eons. And I got to be honest, it's not the greatest match in the world or anything. But when you take some of the politics surrounding it and you get a chance to see Bob Backlund, at the beginning, basically of his WWF title run and looking, physically almost as good as he ever looked. It is a good look, as you mentioned, inside of a time capsule.
Yeah, and like you said, as far as being surprised by it winning the vote, the other matches that were up were Liger, Jushin Thunder Liger versus Aita of Dragon Gate fame, Keiji Muto versus Genichiro Tenryu from May 3rd, 1999 for the IWGP Heavyweight title, and Tetsuya Naito versus Masato Tanaka for the Never Openweight title and Tetsuya Naito's briefcase to allow him to challenge for the IWGP title at Wrestle Kingdom, this match from November 29th, 2013. So, yeah, and we had 192 people voting. So thank you, everyone who voted. We will be doing this again for the next show that we do together. But, yeah, I'll just preface by saying, yes, this is And unsurprisingly, the politics behind this match would dictate a less than satisfying finish. That said, the actual work in the match, I would say particularly for probably the first two thirds of the match, I really enjoyed. I've been doing a fair bit of watching late 70s and early 80s New Japan and actually All Japan as well. I've talked about that on some of the solo shows over the last 6 weeks or so. And it is a very interesting watch if you're not very familiar with watching wrestling from that time period, because one of the things that you get a lot is you get a lot of mat wrestling. You'll get a sequence of maybe one or two high spots, and then you'll get a reset, whether that be one guy rolling out to the ring and coming back in, or both guys just sort of, kind of reassessing, almost like an indie standoff. And then they go back into grappling and going again. And we had that, I would say, six or seven times throughout this match. But, and we can go through the details here, Mike. There was some really, really cool, interesting stuff.
And you know,
like you said, you're really seeing Bob Backlund at the peak of his physical abilities. And you're seeing I will say that to me, the parts of this match that stood out the best were the matches that were, or the parts that were much more, almost like proto shoot style, where it was working holds, working clever ways to get out of holds. Once it went into the more pro wrestling-y stuff with, Irish whips and hammer throws and atomic drops, it wasn't quite as strong, but a lot of good stuff with Backlund out wrestling Inoki early, Inoki getting frustrated. Some great stuff with working, flying head scissors into, a grounded, seated, like, head scissors submission. And Inoki or Backlund trying to get out in different ways they countered. So, I mean, I guess maybe I because I went into it knowing what to expect with the latter portion of the match, I actually found it to be pretty enjoyable.
Oh, absolutely. And, I think, if for people that are a little bit younger or don't particularly enjoy those two guys or their styles or anything like that, you got to get through that feeling out process first, where Inoki is, he tries to impose his physical will on Backlund. And when it comes to throwing chops, when it comes to that type of hand to hand, he's got him. But when it came to being on the mat, Backlund was very aggressive and he, would hold the advantage that way. And it was a little bit of a game back and forth before Inoki was able to kind of get under Backlund's skin at first. And then that, led to Backlund slapping Inoki in the face. And then it was kind of on from there. And once you
awesome. That was, we see that a lot in matches, but it almost just seems like going through the motions. Like this, I thought that came off very, very well. The transition from it being a sporting grappling battle to then, the slap, and then okay, there's some animosity here and some competitiveness, and we're gonna go.
Absolutely, and that was the way of a lot of those types of matches. Ric Flair matches were always classic for that too. It was a lot of times start off very scientific, but then Flair would do something cocky or something or get pissed off and then take a shortcut. And then, it was kind of on from there. And then he'd slap Sting and Sting would slap him back and it was off to the races. And I think once you get to that point in this match, which goes about, what did it go? About 25 minutes or so, what, 28 minutes? Once you hit that point in the match, which probably came about 15 minutes in, it's a little bit more enjoyable. The ball will start rolling a little bit more downhill for you. And, what's notable about this match before we kind of take it to that point and we get towards the end of it is what needs to be mentioned is as this is going on, Bobby Duncum plays a role in this. And the reason I'm going to mention this is overall, because we're going to have to tell you what the exit of all of this was at the end. Might as well set up what the beginning is. And the beginning is that Bobby Duncum had come back to the WWF in October. And he was managed by Captain Lou, and at the television tapings on the 24th and the ones that aired on November 3rd of 1979, Duncum jumped Arnold Skoland, who was on commentary for a match he was having against a scrub. And Backlund attempted to make the save, and he got beaten down. And why that's important is because it led to a match on November 19th at Madison Square Garden where Backlund and Duncum fought to a no contest because both guys were bleeding too much. They stop the match. They hold the belt up. That's the excuse that they will use as they set up the rematch against Bobby Duncan and Backlund that would take place at Madison Square Garden on December 17th. As we go into Japan, the match with Inoki is taking place on November 30th. So we've got to set up what's supposed to be happening later on. And here's the thing about the Madison Square Garden show. Inoki is supposed to be on that show facing off against the Iron Sheik, which means that footage is going back to Japan. So you're going to need an explanation for both America and Japan for what we're going to talk about with what takes place in this match here.
Yes. No, that's a very good recap of sort of the lay of the land. And yeah, the finish to this, I don't know if you want to get straight to the finish or if you want to talk about a few other things. I love, sure, by the way, the struggle for on both ends for the double underhook suplex.
Yes.
So that was very, very good as well.
The deadlift from Backlund with Inoki too.
Yes.
And this is the thing too. A lot of people think of Backlund, they think howdy doody or whatever. And it's like Backlund was physically,
he was a freak.
He was, and he, you look at the size of his wrists, look at the size of his calves. This guy was a high level amateur wrestler with a motor that didn't stop. And a lot of people go, well, why, how could he be believable? Because people knew he could whip your ass. You may have thought he was a geek, but you were afraid of this geek because this geek could hurt you. And you look at him physically against Inoki, he is physically bigger than Inoki. And it's a reminder that not only did Inoki radiate bigger than actually he was, but Backlund at his best also did that. And he was just a physical wonder. And that lift with Inoki is always, anytime Backlund did it, and he did it with everybody, it was always amazing. But just, it's a reminder of how freakishly strong he was.
Yes. Inoki had Backlund in a short arm scissors. And Backlund does, you know, the deadlift, one arm deadlift, while Inoki is still holding onto the short arm scissors, picks him up all the way over his head with one arm, and then walks him over to the corner, sets him on the corner, and slaps him, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and the thing is too,
that was the spot of the match. Like, if this is a gif-able match, that would be the one that I'd love to see.
And I, you know, again, unless people have seen it, they don't really believe it. But like, if Inoki wanted to dead weight Backlund on that, Backlund was still strong enough to get him up. He may have blown a testicle doing it. Maybe he had a hernia, but he would have actually been able to get, that's how strong Backlund was before he decided to change his training, go to all cardio and basically, you know, atrophy and that kind of, unfortunately, becoming the Backlund that a lot of people know from his WWF days in late 82 into early 83 and when Hogan took over in 84.
All right, let's get to the finish of this match.
Tiger Jeet Singh stormed down to the ring to be a headache and to also kind of set up what the rest of the week was going to be for both Backlund and Inoki over in Japan. He comes down to ringside to cause a distraction, and we get a finish, which is very much out of the NWA and Dusty Rhodes in 1986. Unfortunately, and I don't know, I guess unfortunately, how do you want to describe this? Because it looked like Backlund got the pin with the atomic drop after Tiger Jeet Singh ran down to the ring to distract the referee. It's just, unfortunately, the referee didn't count three. His hand hit the mat to rest it as Inoki kicked out. But Backlund, hearing the audible of it, thought he had got a three count, and that led to Inoki sneaking.
That's exactly what happened. So Tiger Jeet Singh tries to interfere. The New Japan wrestlers at ringside stop him, start pulling him away. At that point, Backlund hits Inoki with a huge atomic drop. Like you said, it appears as though there may have been or should have been a three count. But it doesn't happen. Inoki barely kicks out. It's one of those deals. Tiger Jeet Singh, at that point, is still out there. Backlund is distracted. Antonio Inoki hits a backdrop suplex, goes for the pin, and the ref counts three. The hand hits the mat pretty much right as Bob Backlund kicks out. So the ref rules that Inoki is, in fact, won. He wins the WWF title. And then it kind of gets crazy. Backlund and Tiger Jeet Singh are sort of having a huge pull apart. The wrestlers are able to get them pulled apart. And at one point, then Inoki comes over while the wrestlers are holding Tiger Jeet Singh back and punches him several times. Also, Seiji Sakaguchi grabs Tiger Jeet Singh's chain and starts choking him with that. In the meantime, Bob Backlund is going crazy with a chair, chases Tiger Jeet Singh partially away. They're throwing chairs at each other in the crowd, which is terrifying.
It was crazy. Mike Tyson pushed a guy. Vince McMahon said, "You ruined everything, Austin." It was crazy.
Yes, it was a scene. It was chaotic. Inoki then finally gets in the ring, or is in the ring, and is able to start celebrating his win. There's a sportscaster type interviewer that is just annoying the hell out of Inoki, trying to get him to talk, trying to get him to do an interview, and it just isn't happening. Meanwhile, Bob Backlund gets in the ring and he's arguing vociferously with referee Red Shoes Dugan, that it was three and that the match should have been stopped, that he should have won right then and there. The ref says no. Then Tiger Jeet Singh comes back out. Bob Backlund is, there's a standoff with Bob Backlund and Tiger Jeet Singh. Singh has the chain, Backlund has the chair. Inoki is getting visibly frustrated that his celebration, you know, has been very much muted. He's yelling outside of the ring. Finally, he gets his trophy, but Bob Backlund is back in the ring arguing with the referee again. The sportscaster finally gets a chance to start interviewing Inoki. Then Bob Backlund grabs the mic, starts screaming that the referee counted three. And unfortunately, the clip ends here because Bob Backlund is definitely going into like 1993 Bob Backlund mode, losing his mind here.
Yes, he was. And, you know, what this leads to, because everything else on this tour, which ended up wrapping up on December 6th, every other Inoki match was a tag team encounter. He only had one title defense on this tour that didn't have anything to do with Bob Backlund, and that was against Pedro Morales on December 4th. Only the NWF title was on the line. The WWF championship actually wasn't even on the line for that, but on that card, Bob Backlund defeated Tiger Jeet Singh, which in theory got Tiger Jeet Singh and any claim that he had to Inoki or any claim he had to Backlund or any shot that he wanted to have in Inoki's title out of the way. So Backlund then went and faced Inoki on December 6th, where, you know, depending on who you talk to, especially, you know, years ago, you would ask about this. Was there a double cross? Was Shinma, was Inoki, were they trying to keep the belt in Japan and leave Backlund, you know, coming back to the States without it? Was that what they were truly trying to do? And years later, we find out that that's actually all a work. That's not what they were trying to do. But for years, a lot of people had speculated over, were they trying to keep the belt in Japan, when in reality, they wanted to make sure that Inoki stayed strong and made sure that his world championship claim was still something that he could prop up, like his world martial arts title would end up becoming later on, which is essentially what his NWF title would morph into, at least when he would come over to the States.
Yes. Yeah. And that rematch, by the way, is also on New Japan World. So that's something that, who knows, maybe in addition to whatever match ends up winning the fan vote next week, the listener vote, I should say, we will, maybe we'll get into that match a little bit more on an upcoming show as well. So, with that, Mike, I know that you have to go.